Chuck Smeaton from the Royal Institution of Australia, and this is the Cosmos Briefing Podcast. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Kaurna people, traditional owners of the land where I speak to you from today, and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. With half of the world's population now living in cities, a number that is projected to reach two-thirds in the coming decades, people are becoming increasingly disconnected from their food, both geographically and conceptually. Food travels greater distances, leading to increased waste and supply chain vulnerability. History tells us that during times of stress, people turn to urban agriculture. Therefore, it's no surprise that COVID-19 has seen a resurgence of urban agriculture for its contributions towards food security, health, and well-being. Moreover, urban agriculture has been identified as a key strategy for adapting to climate change. Recent analysis identified it as a $4 billion growth opportunity for Australia. So is urban agriculture just a nice idea or a plausible reality? Today, Cosmos journalist Dr. Deborah Davis talks to three experts from the University of Adelaide. Isabel Hume, a PhD candidate, Dr. Mattia Solomon, an urban soil health researcher, and Tim Cavagnaro, a professor in soil ecology in the School of Agriculture, Food and Wine, to get some insights.
So we've been talking a lot about how we can ensure that we have a food secure future. So Tim, tell me about what urban agriculture is and why we should care about that.
So urban agriculture is the practice of producing food, and that can be plants or animals or livestock in and around urban infrastructure and environments. So it could be production of food in a factory type environment, so growing crops under lights and protected horticulture, or it could be growing things in community gardens or vegetables in your own backyard. And the reason that we're interested in this is since about 2016, more than half of the world's population now lives in urban areas. And with that shift of people to the city, they've become increasingly disconnected from their food source. And so it's really helping to people understand how their food's produced and an appreciation of that. And urban agriculture has the potential to produce meaningful amounts of food where the people who consume it are residing.
I really find it interesting that you said the disconnection with food, we're seeing that, because that shows that there's this cultural aspect is behind it as well. But presumably there's still a lot of soil quality and space that is really necessary. So if we're looking at a city like Adelaide, is this a good place for agriculture, Matt?
Yeah, I think Adelaide is definitely an excellent place for urban agriculture. We have a lot of space to do urban agriculture. And in my research, I also found out that the urban agriculture soils in Adelaide are really highly fertile and loaded with nutrients. And another very interesting and important aspect is that none of the samples that we tested exceeded the national guidelines for heavy metal contamination. So this is always a bit of a concern when you're growing food in an urban environment, but it wasn't the case in our studies. And another very interesting aspect, I think, is all urban gardeners that I came across, they practiced the principles of organic farming. So they refrain from using pesticides or mineral fertilizer, and instead they only used organic fertilizers to improve their soil. And in the case of Adelaide, it was mostly horse manure, which they collected from the racetrack. And another thing I would like to mention here, which is really interesting, is all the gardeners were a bit too enthusiastic about those freely available fertilizer. And that's something we see not just in Adelaide, but in other studies around the world, such as in the Netherlands or in Spain. And it just shows that there's this imbalance of plant nutrients and especially excessive levels of phosphorus in the soils. And it just highlights that all major cities produce this abundance of potential plant fertilizer. So that's a really good thing for your soil, but someone just needs to tell the gardeners to use a bit less or just to use a different fertilizer. In our case, a fertilizer which has less phosphorus.
Izzy, can you give me an overview of your research and what your main results were?
Sure. So The first lot of research that I did, all I do really is to do with mapping and modelling urban space. And really, I'm looking at the physical constraints on urban agriculture. So, you know, often urban agriculture is kind of looked at through the social element, and often from an advocacy standpoint, there are a lot of amazing reasons why people engage in urban agriculture, and there are a lot of benefits to be had from urban agriculture. But there's been less work really critically analysing the feasibility, you know, how much food could be grown, what resources would be required, what would that look like from an environmentally sustainable standpoint long into the future. So we're kind of, you know, being researchers, kind of taking a really critical lens and putting it under the pump, putting it to the test and seeing if it really is feasible. So we found that there is enough space, definitely in Adelaide, for people to grow a meaningful amount of food. So the typical home has enough lawn space to be able to grow 5 serves of veggies per day. Moving forward now, the next thing we're looking at is water as a resource and figuring out if you can irrigate crops in an urban environment sustainably. We're kind of looking at rooftop rainwater harvesting as one potential avenue for that. So, you know, as the climate gets drier, irrigation is going to be a really big issue for food production across Australia, not only in urban areas, but with all the sealed surfaces in urban spaces, there's this unique opportunity to harvest water that would otherwise become stormwater and be a waste product and use that as an agricultural input. So kind of looking at the opportunities and perhaps limitations that exist within an urban environment for growing food.
And Isabel, I heard that you've been peeking into people's backyards. Tell me why that was.
I have been peeking into people's backyards. So we use airborne imagery to kind of get an overview of how much space there actually was in Adelaide backyards to grow food. You know, Matt already mentioned that Adelaide is such a great place for urban agriculture because of how much space we have. And I think maybe living in a low density city, we kind of take that for granted, but that's actually really unique and something special to Adelaide. So, you know, we know that we have a lot of public green space, but we also, most people would have access to their own private yard, which is a great place to grow food because it kind of takes down a lot of those initial barriers, maybe when you think about, and, you know, setting something up or, you know, the administrative barriers. So we calculated how much land there was to grow food, and we actually found out that a typical home in Adelaide would have more than enough space to meet their daily recommended vegetable intake if they just dedicated a portion of the land that was currently lawn. So just dedicating a small amount of your lawn space could really help you grow a meaningful amount of food.
And would this continue long term? Is this something that's feasible for the future?
So it's definitely true that urban areas are changing, and I'm sure a lot of people kind of notice that there is a trend towards having smaller backyards, which does add spatial pressure for backyard farming. But you can still have a really productive garden on just a small amount of land. And we've actually seen that small gardens can be more economically viable because you can kind of grow those high value crops. And even if you are just farming in a very small area or, you know, on a balcony or something like that, you do get a lot of those social benefits that larger gardens get as well. So even if you're not someone who has access to a lot of land, you can still definitely benefit from urban agriculture.
And Matt, similar question, are we going to remain having good soil into the future that will be useful for urban agriculture?
I think yes, definitely, because farmers and urban gardeners are really eager to improve their knowledge and to learn new tips and tricks. And it's something that we also do. We go back to the community gardens, for example, and we communicate our findings and telling them what their soil looks like and that what they can do for the future to further improve it. Is very well received by the farmers and very well received. And so I have no doubt that people who are interested in urban agriculture and backyard farming, that they also want to have this deep understanding of soil ecology. And I think there's also nowadays a lot of means to get this knowledge, for example, through the internet. So I think, urban agriculture is in a good place to have good soil health for the future.
And that seems like there's a lot of practical reasons why it might be a good way to ensure that we have this food security. But we do have to then think about household and state economies. So, Tim, how do you think that urban agriculture could affect those economies?
That's a really interesting question. And it's if we look back in history when people have engaged in urban agriculture and, you know, there's been a big uptake in activity, it's often been in times of stress. So, for example, around the First and Second World War, there was a lot of mandates around people producing food in their own backyards in what we call victory gardens. In the COVID-19 pandemic, when we suddenly couldn't go to the shops, when we had shutdowns, people got very concerned about their food security. And so there was, again, a lot of interest in urban agriculture around that time. And there's some really interesting statistics where if you look at the number of Google searches on how to grow vegetables, in April last year, there was a massive increase in those searches because people went to the vegetable, they went to the garden center or the hardware store and they bought some plants or some seeds. And then they thought, right, how do I turn these into food that I can eat? And so it really gets to that question around self-reliance. And I think that is an important part of the economic sort of paradigm. Also, if you look forward into the future, the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, has identified urban agriculture as a really important way of addressing or adapting to climate change. And so that's, a time of future stress that we need to think about as well. So there's that individual self-reliance. I think also the economics is a really interesting question, depending on the scale that you look at it. So an individual gardener who produces their food for themselves, that's obviously one thing, but then you might get informal trading of produce between neighbours, or you could scale that up to the community level, or you could go to a farmer's market. And so there's different scales that you can operate on. I think the other aspect around the economics is if you're producing the food very close to where you consume it, that reduces things like the need to transport that food from one place to another. And so there's also economic elements to that as well. So it's not something that we've looked at in a great deal of detail, but we're increasingly getting interested in that sort of socioeconomic component around urban agriculture and why people engage in it. Another angle actually that's really important to mention here is there was a recent study in Victoria where they looked at the demographics of people who engaged in urban agriculture. And it was often found that a large proportion of urban gardeners were people who had a lower income. And so they might have had a large income, but they might have had time that they could invest in this activity. And so that allowed them to supplement their diet with healthy fruits and vegetables. And they could also potentially trade that with people who might be less time poor, but are looking for that produce themselves as well. So yeah, there are some interesting economic questions around that I think we need to look in further.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, the study was from Melbourne. So Izzy, you looked at people's backyards in Adelaide, but how is that going to translate to other states in Australia?
Well, I think what we did was by kind of parameterizing how much land you would need, you can definitely extrapolate that out to other areas and understanding the, you know, minimum spatial requirements to be able to achieve self-sufficiency. We found that a home of 2.5 people would only need about 20 metres squared of land. Depending on how productive your garden is, obviously some people might be able to achieve, might need a bit more land than that to grow all the veggies that they need. But by understanding how much space you would need, you can then start to incorporate that into planning and you can really use those figures anywhere in Australia.
And Matt, you said that you had spoken to a lot of people who were using fertilizers, a lot of people who were farming, and this is all a really interesting social insight to what people are choosing. Did you notice any particularly interesting trends?
Well, yes, there are some trends that go through the farming communities, like the Bokashi fermenting as a way of composting. All of a sudden, everyone was talking about this. That's just one example of how everyone is connected somehow in this one big community, and they pick up ideas from each other. But generally, I think since the 3 or 4 years that we're doing this research, there has been a certain trend towards more knowledge-based decision-making. I think a couple of years ago, often people, if I asked them why they would do certain things, they said, oh, the gut feeling tells me to do this. And I think this changed a little bit. And I think it's a reflection of how the farming communities are connected with each other and how they are educating each other as well.
So practically then, what comes next if we want to become a country that's known for our urban agriculture cities? Tim, what could that look like and what do we need to do to achieve that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess one thing we need to do is to preserve the land. Okay, so as we develop our cities, we need to make sure that we leave land available to sort of future-proof so we have the capability to do this. What we've demonstrated is that we have healthy soils and we have enough land to do this. We just need to make sure that we maintain that. So that's the key thing. I think another really important aspect is around education. So when, you know, growing up in Adelaide in the 1980s, a lot of people were engaging in backyard agriculture. We all had big veggie patches, there were chickens running around, all that kind of thing. And I think that's less common nowadays. And something that we've encountered is a lot of people have a desire to engage in agriculture, but they don't necessarily have the knowledge. And so I think there's some really important work to be done around educating urban farmers. I think another thing is often urban agriculture has been looked at as a bit of a hobby, but actually I think we need to look at it through the lens of a serious farming system. So really look at all of the constraints and challenges and opportunities and treat it in that sort of farming systems approach. And I think through that we'll identify, you know, key issues around soil health, safety, so around heavy metals and how you deal with those in potentially contaminated sites. If people are producing their own compost, how do you do that so that it provides the nutrients, but it's also safe to do so? For example, if you're using manures, there's important things that you need to manage there as well. So I think there's a really important education piece. I see that as a big part of the future. Another is around identifying the barriers. Why do people engage in this? Why do they not engage in it, even if they might like to? And so identifying some of those particular sort of social constraints will be important as well.
And if we're zooming down on the individual, Isabel, do you have any tips for someone who wants to start growing their own food in their backyard or on their balcony?
I think it's just a matter of, yeah, getting out and doing it. You know, I think a lot of people, if you're someone who doesn't have that knowledge already, you know, finding out if there is a community garden in your area and connecting with people and talking to people who are doing it, because there is a wealth of knowledge. And even if it seems like people don't feel like they have it themselves, there's definitely going to be people in their community who want to teach and want to learn. And I think more and more there are community groups cropping up and people who just want to share their information. So I think it's just a matter of knowing where to find the information that you're looking for.
And do you have any tips, Matt?
Well, I think if you want to start going into backyard farming and doing more intense gardening and growing your own food, I think it's important to realize that it is not as time consuming as some people think it is. If you have a good setup and you have the proper know-how, you can actually do it even on a busy schedule. Of course, it's easier said than done. First, you have to get there. But it's not either or other. You can have a normal work-life balance and still do gardening and enjoy it.
It's not a dusk till dawn job, no. Which means we can be flexible around it. And if there's one take-home message you want people to remember, Tim, what would that be?
I've got several, but I'll try and pick
the, you can have more than one.
I can have more than one, thank you. So I think the key is that urban agriculture has the potential to produce meaningful amounts of food. I think we have done it in the past and will continue to do it in the future, and it will become an increasingly important part of our food system. To me, that's a really exciting thing to think of, getting people more engaged in where their food comes from and understanding it for, you know, simple reasons like if you produce food, you're less likely to waste that food. You're also less likely to waste other food that you might purchase because you know the work and effort that went into that. So I guess I would just encourage people to, if they're interested in this, to engage in it, have a go. Don't be put off by the setbacks. You know, we've all had crop failures. I'm not embarrassed to say that myself. Just really get in there and have a go. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are keen to help and educate you in how to do that.
Well, thank you so much, everyone. That is really fascinating research, especially because so many people want to engage in it now. So I hope everybody's future is full of tasty carrots and plump potatoes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. Remember that you can head to cosmosmagazine.com via the link in the description for more great content. You can also subscribe to Cosmos Magazine, Australia's only science print magazine, and Cosmos Weekly, with its unique approach to how science, news, and the economy intersect. Podcast listeners can get both products at a special price using the coupon code you will also find in the description. Of course, you can watch and listen to all our Cosmos briefings via the link in the description too. And remember, if you support science and its communication, please support our work at the Royal Institution of Australia. I'm Chuck Smeaton, and today's interview was conducted by Dr. Deborah Davis. Thank you.